All right. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. This title, I realize, sounds like there is everything thrown into this talk that you could possibly imagine. In a way, there is. It's not because I'm short of things to say, but in many ways, I think these are all different aspects, dimensions, facets of a single and important evolutionary event. Let me introduce my co-authors, two fantastic experimentalists, Katrin Hammerschmidt and Caroline Rose, Eric Libby and Yuri Pishagin, two mathematicians, theorists, Ben Kerr, friend and colleague at the University of Washington. I'm going to start off with a few slides that provide a personal perspective and motivation for getting into what I'm going to tell you about. I'm going to do this in the hope that you will see why some of these ideas might make sense, even though at first glance they seem curiously, or may seem curiously, left of center. So a long time ago, actually when I was a master's student in the mid-1980s, I became interested in the explosive radiation of this bacterium, common orgard in Pseudomonas fluorescens, grows on a plant leaf surface when placed in spatially structured microcosms, test tubes that are left on the laboratory bench. Within a small number of generations, 20 to 30 generations, this population of single clone has diversified into a range of types evident by different colony morphologies. They're genetically distinct mutants. The remarkable thing about these different types is that when placed back into the microcosm and the environment in which they evolved, they show evidence of niche specificity. Here's the ancestral type, colonizes the broth phase, and this one, about which I'll talk extensively, a wrinkly spreader type, forms these thick mats at the air-liquid interface. These wrinkly spreaders are numerous. They can arise by numerous different mutational routes involving simple to complex mutations. I will say very little about the genetics here, but happy to talk about that extensively. It fascinates me no end. So many different kinds of wrinkly spreaders that arise relatively simply from this ancestral type. So what is it about these wrinkly spreaders that makes them worthy of study? Well, they look great for a start, these wrinkled spreading morphologies, but it's their capacity to colonize the air-liquid interface that really interested me. So here is the ancestor simulated here, binary fission. Sooner or later, a mutation to this wrinkly spreader type emerges. The mutations, as I said, many different mutations, find ways to activate diguanylate cyclases. Diguanylate cyclases, when overactive, produce cyclic diGMP. This is a signaling molecule that causes constitutive activation of various glues, including the production of a cellulose, an acetylated cellulose polymer. This is effectively a glue. In fact, there are multiple glues under the control of these diguanylate cyclases. So a wrinkly spreader type eventually gets to the air-liquid interface. In fact, if it begins to form a group on the bottom, it's fated for extinction. So forming this mat, the air-liquid interface, is crucial for the development of this mat. The cells, by virtue of this mutation and the production of this glue, do not separate fully at cell division time. They are therefore able to spread across the air-liquid interface in a single layer and then glue themselves onto the side. In fact, the mat will very often start from the sides and move toward the center. The mat's not buoyant. It doesn't float there. It sits there by virtue of the interactions between these glue-producing bacterial cells. It's costly for these cells to produce the glue. It's, after all, glucose. You better to metabolize it. They excrete vast amounts of it. These cells, upon acquiring this mutation, grow considerably slower than the ancestral type. This production of glue is favored by selection because of what is obtainable to the cells that are within this group, this collective, and that is oxygen. There is plenty of oxygen at the air-liquid interface. These bacteria need oxygen. Growth of the ancestral type in the broth phase, in fact, depletes that environment of oxygen. That, in fact, establishes the selective conditions that favor these types that form this collective at the air-liquid interface. So these cells, although costly to express this trait, acquire something after the production of this, or the formation of this mat, which is valuable to them, and that is oxygen, which is available here and not down here. So this collective of cells works together to achieve something that the individual cells cannot achieve. something akin, in fact, to an ant bridge. It's costly to engage in this behavior, and you would expect, theory tells us, and experiment confirms, that we would see the evolution of types that cheat. So no sooner do we see this wonderful mat than the mat gets cancer. These cancerous growths are cells that don't produce the glue. They reap all the benefits of oxygen at the air-liquid interface, but they contribute nothing to the strength of the mat. When those cell types, these non-glue producers, become numerous, the mat collapses, the inevitable downside of cooperation, classic tragedy of the commons. Here it is in real time. Over the course of 4 days, started with the ancestral type. So this is not inoculated with the mat-forming type. The mat-forming type needs to arise by a single mutation and colonize the air-liquid interface. And you can see within a few days, if you look carefully, that there is the start of a, there we are. You see a mat begin to detach there. In a little while, you'll see a wholesale collapse of this mat that has emerged from a single mutation, colonized the air-liquid interface, collapsed as a consequence. There you saw the collapse there. Why wouldn't the wild type? Well, it could be. It could. I mean, yes. I will talk a little bit about this. Indeed, in fact, the capacity to go from mat forming type to non-mat forming type to mat forming to non-mat forming is possible by mutation. And indeed, we've documented a lot of those mutations. So, the evolution of these groups, de novo, we have the ecological context when they make sense, they arise simply, we understand a lot about them. So a long time ago, I began to be interested in the possibility that we might do a Rychlensky type of experiment where we subjected these groups to evolution by natural selection. So instead of evolving individual cells, we evolve groups of cells. And surely we could observe the adaptive evolution of groups. But of course, this does require that these groups can participate in evolutionary processes, particularly evolution by natural selection. And it took a while to dawn on me, but wrinkly spreader mats are actually not Darwinian individuals. It's not possible for them to participate in an open-ended way in the process of evolution by natural selection. Although there is substantial variation among wrinkly spreader mats, and by virtue of the hereditary material in individual cells, there is heredity. The groups themselves, short of me or another experimentalist intervening and becoming their means of reproduction, lack this capacity. And indeed, it's possible to do experiments where an experimenter is the means of group-level reproduction. But as I said, it precludes the open-ended evolution of groups. Moreover, in becoming part of the Darwinian process of these entities, one also establishes the kind of selective conditions that you will favor. So yes, sure, we can do a selection experiment where we select for the strongest groups, the prettiest groups, be what you may. It's not, though, the same as observing the open-ended evolution of groups. So this brings us to the evolution of individuality, about which much has been said. What I want to emphasize here is that it is a derived trait. It requires an evolutionary explanation. In particular, as we go from single cells to collectives, although, as I mentioned, there is variation by virtue of the properties of the cells, and there is heredity to some extent, there is not typically the capacity for collective-level reproduction. And as one goes from single cells to multi-cells, I think the greatest challenge is explaining how that comes about. So just to be clear again, but going quickly over it, because it's been touched upon, Darwinian individuality, here I use the Lewontin concept, an abstract notion of a minimal set of conditions by which individuals will evolve by natural selection. It will take place in any collection of individuals in which there is variation, heredity, and differences in reproductive success. So variation, reproduction, and heredity, with at least some of that variation linked to reproductive differences. Any collection of entities with these properties is a Darwinian population. An individual is a Darwinian, within that population is a Darwinian individual. Entities with these properties are often referred to as Darwinian machines, as units of selection. Again, quickly over this, it's apparent from the thinking of many people and presentations at this workshop that individuality in this Darwinian sense exists at multiple levels of biological organization. Here are just a number of them. Important point is that adaptations arise at the level at which selection acts. It doesn't make sense to think of selection acting on cells giving rise to traits that are adaptive at the level of the multicellular organism. So we're thinking about transitions in individuality as we think about the transition from single cells to multicellular individuals, a major evolutionary transition central to the evolution of biological complexity. And we know that during evolution of life, selection has transitioned from acting on individual entities that are Darwinian individuals, part of Darwinian populations, to collectives of those entities, where those collectives also evolved by natural selection by virtue of the fact that they are Darwinian machines. The causes of these shifts in individuality are what interest me and obviously most of us here. And this to me is what I think of the many questions that could be asked here, a central one. How does a population of cells, at this point here, become a single entity capable of collective level reproduction? How does evolution of collective reproduction come about? The reason I think it's so important is that the moment there is some semblance of collective reproduction, then that entity, whatever it is, will participate to some extent or another in the evolutionary process, both by Darwinian and non-Darwinian means. Non-Darwinian if there's no connection between variation and reproductive success. Darwinian if there is that connection. Again, by way of just outlining and pointing to where our problem lies, here we have a very simplified view echoing that put forward by Rick Michaud this morning of a transition between individual cells. An early stage seems to be formation of groups. Our wrinkly spreader groups would seem to be an example of this. Very often it involves some sort of cooperation. Inevitably the conflict that I talked about here. Then we have the evolution of individuality, at which point we've got collectives that beget collectives. These collectives can participate marginally, maybe to begin with, in the process of evolution by natural selection. Selection acting at this level can give rise to the diversity of multicellular forms that we've seen. So again, this is what interests me, how we get from these earliest groups to groups that participate in the evolutionary process. Once that happens, it's all over. Anything is possible. So the evolution of collective reproduction is what I think is key. And it's not straightforward if you sit back and think about it. As it says here, at stage two, a miracle occurs. Now, as Mike and Will's work, about which we've spoken a moment ago, points out that actually that miracle can happen. It can have the most simplest of explanations. But if you sit back and you think about what happens during that stage, as we go from simple collectives to collectives that reproduce themselves, it's not straightforward, and I don't think it's been much thought about. So where does one begin? Well, here with the simplest reproducing groups, and in our case, they seem to be groups that fundamentally lack this ability to reproduce themselves at all. Well, some recent work with Eric Libby, I mentioned this in passing in the Chalk Talk last week, led us to think, actually very recently, but I think possibly quite usefully, about the simplest kinds of groups that might participate in evolutionary process. And first of all, one needs an idea about a set of sufficient conditions that would constitute a multicellular organism. Ours are deliberately permissive and would encompass the most unlikely candidates for multicellularity. So first of all, the group must exist. There must be some group state that is recognizable. It could be an ephemeral state, it could be due to some external boundary, it could be some sort of taxis to a point, it could be glue production. Secondly, the groups must be able to multiply, and when they do so, pass on, to some extent, heritable information. And without either of those two, there is no evolution possible by Darwinian or non-Darwinian means. Now, this first stage is met by our definition down here. Here we have an individual, it divides, gives rise to an individual, but every now and then will give rise to a G cell, which by virtue of, let's say, a glue, sticks to its offspring and we now have a group. And there's another round of division, we've got our group. So the group exists, but to qualify as a multicellular organism, in the loosest and most abstract sense, these groups must be capable of multiplication and the sharing of heritable information. So thinking about this led to the recognition that there's really only three basic ways by which this can come about. Here's a type 1 organism. We have type 2, and we'll very quickly get to type 3, because type 3 is irrelevant to our story with wrinkly spreaders. Here is that individual cell. Well, let's just come down here. This is a multicellular organism by virtue of the fact that groups can reproduce. The multicellular organism is the group state itself because the groups can beget groups. This is exemplified, in fact, by the yeast experiment that Mike Travisano just told us about. So here is an I type. It gives rise to a G group. And that G group, in this case, by virtue of fragmentation, gives rise to G offspring. So here we have what I think is almost miraculous, a group of cells that evolves that has the capacity right off to leave offspring. So that's an example of a type 1 organism. Reproduction here is by a fission event. Here is a type 2 organism. Here the organism is a combination of I and G states. The I state reproduces itself and gives rise to G states, group states. The groups cannot reproduce themselves. They must reproduce by virtue of some interaction with I. This would reflect, if there is some interaction between G and I, the distinction between soma and germ and metazoans. Here's type 3. So type 3, like type 2, the multicellular organism is also a combination of these two different cell types, I's and G's. Here, I's reproduce, they give rise to groups. Groups give rise to I's. So there is a back and forward between the two. And again, that's shown here. Groups give rise to I's. I's give rise to I's and also to other groups. So here, there is a similarity or an exact parallel between our wrinkly spreader groups that form from I cells that can give rise to I cells, that can give rise to groups, that can give rise to individual cells, and so on. So I'm selling something here. I'm selling the idea that the difficulty that we are confronted with is these wrinkly spreader groups that seem to have no means of reproduction actually do have a means of reproduction if we consider the notion that the cheats, which are an inevitable consequence of the tensions that exist between the higher and the lower levels, are not seen as the bad guys. Rather, the tension that exists there could be embraced and might fuel some sort of progress towards an evolutionary transition. So here, the idea is that we can go between groups, and groups can beget groups by virtue of the cheating type, but let's throw the version of the cheating type out the door, the non-producing type, which acts as a kind of a propagule or proto-germ line. So we get then a life cycle for free where we go from groups to individuals to groups to individuals to groups as a consequence of the tensions that exist between the interests of the group and the interests of the individual cells. And it can fuel, at least the idea is, some sort of proto-life cycle, a life cycle, if you like, for free. So here is our wrinkly spreader still. It's cells. It's this mat. Rather like soma, it's an evolutionary dead end. It goes nowhere. It cannot reproduce itself short of us intervening. By mutation, initially, we can see the evolution of types that, while they destroy the mat, can, in an appropriate ecology, leave that mat-forming environment and, given appropriate ecology, give rise once again, by mutation initially, to the mat-forming type. And there we have a life cycle representing a type 3 organism. There is very interesting coupling between the activities of these organisms and the state of the environment that also fuels this life cycle and provides conditions, in fact, that we argue with Eric are conducive to the evolution of development. But that's another story. So putting that in the context of the cartoon you saw a moment ago, individual cells, groups, wrinkly spreader groups, for example, and here we have these groups that are begetting groups. The idea here is we need to think about how group-level reproduction emerges early in simple steps. One idea involves a type 3 organism where that group can, in fact, beget group copies via these cells that we typically see as destroying the function of the group. Indeed, they are, on one hand, the nemesis of the individual group-forming cells that make up that collective, but they are the savior of the group at the same time. Indeed, cheats, while the nemesis of the mats from a single cell perspective, are its savior from the level of the collective. the existence of this proto-life cycle provides potentially some opportunity for evolution, even selection, to proceed at the group level and gets us out of that dilemma. Well, one thing you're probably already thinking is that a life cycle by mutation, as we are requiring here, is not viable in the long term. Absolutely, it's not viable. But some sort of a clunky life cycle driven by mutation might just be enough to get things going. And indeed, this is so arising from the experiment I'll tell you about in a moment, are mutations that remove this transition from mutational control and put it under epigenetic control. The life cycle must come under some sort of developmental control to be viable. It's perhaps possible on the basis of what we've seen and now what we've done. I think actually, although one might think that genetically this is where the limitations would come, I think actually the ecological conditions are more limiting in many instances. And you might notice this close parallels between a wrinkly spreader mat and the reproduction of a mouse. Not really, but. All right, some empirical realization of these ideas. So these experimental Pseudomonas populations, I've already introduced you to them, the evolution of cooperation in these mats and the inevitable conflict, the notion that the tension between these different interests of the group and the lower level fuel a life cycle whereby groups can potentially give rise to groups. So we're interested in the possibility that a life cycle emerges in this way. Can it? Moreover, if it can selection act on this life cycle? Can it do anything to affect a transition in individuality? This is Caroline Rose and Katrin Hammerschmidt, who have done just the most enormous experiment. It's involved tens of thousands of tubes, and I hate to think how many hours and weekends and nights spent in the lab. It would be nice to be able to robotize this, but I don't think it ever could be. It's required dedicated human hands. Here is our life cycle. This is how it works. So our organism exists in two phases. There are two phases to the life cycle. We start off with a single cell of the mat-forming type, single colony. It was derived from a single cell. It enters into a microcosm. It spends 6 days in there. At the end of that 6 day period, for the organism to avoid extinction, the body, the mat, must be intact. If it's fallen in, the organism is considered extinct and removed. At the end of that 6 day period, we say time's up. You will die now, but if you've left some offspring, well, your offspring go on. So we harvest the cells, provided there is a mat intact, at the 6 day period. We look at the plate, and we see then if there are any of the non-mat-forming cells. If they are, they are removed, and they are taken separately, mixed together. The entire reproductive output is collected, and they are put into phase two, which is the same a different microcosm, but also a static one. The period is 3 days. During this phase, it is necessary for the organism to complete the life cycle for mutations to have arisen to regenerate the mat-forming type. So that is, and then a single colony of the dominant mat-forming variant on the plate is taken, and the process is repeated. So again, this is how the life cycle works out. I would like to for it to be less contrived, and we've ended up doing it here, but it's been necessary for experimental reasons. What we are not requiring, in fact, because this is wrought by selection, are the transitions between the different states. That comes because selection favoring the mat-forming type, and then selection at a particular stage in the life cycle favoring the non-mat-producing types. Propagule doesn't form a mat. No, that's right. That's right, yes, and continue that process, yeah. Well, so in this experiment we've done 10. In other contexts, we've taken them through more than 20. And characterized, there's a great deal of many decades, actually. Genetics underpins our understanding here. It is remarkable what is possible. But the best groups, jumping right to the head, find ways eventually to free themselves of mutation to go through this. So they find a bistable state, which is generated by mutation. And definitely, as you'll see in the next slide, extinction. This is not easy to achieve, this life cycle by mutation, as you already point out. But I think in part that's what's kind of interesting. It's very easy to go through a few cycles. Genetically, we understand why. But once those easy routes are exhausted, Well, then it depends on what might have happened in the past. You either go extinct or you find some innovative ways to proceed. Yeah. Well, you'll see this, in fact, in this slide here. So just to point out that extinction is highly likely. There are three stages during the life cycle where extinction is possible. The organism fails. So it fails if it does not have a mat at 6 days at the end of phase one. If it's not left any propagules, it's also failed. It's simply removed. And if after the three-day period in phase two, the propagule has failed to produce the mat again, that line would go extinct. So extinction takes place at three stages. In this regime that I'm going to tell you about here, where there's no between group selection going on, selection is primarily on viability, although there is the fecundity aspect too. If it doesn't produce propagules, it can't go on. But mostly we're selecting here on viability. If you're viable, you get through and you get to start again. No between group competition at this stage. One experimental unit has eight microcosms in it. We typically have 15 replicates of that experimental unit. So what I'm going to show you here is data on that shows what happens when you take 15 replicates through these life cycles with no mixing between groups and with extinction going on. We start off, therefore, with 120 microcosms. After one cycle through, all but 39 have gone extinct. The largest number of them went extinct because they failed to produce the propagule at phase two. A very small, one out of 120 failed at the very first step, failed to produce a mat-forming type, so very easy. A number failed because the mat had collapsed at 6 days. So we're down to 39 viable groups. And very quickly, in fact, by generation six, the experiment is over. Everything has gone extinct. So it's a tough regime. It's requiring a lot. And from a genetic perspective, you're getting a mutation, which creates something, then you're suppressing it. So it's like a suppressor of a suppressor of a suppressor of a suppressor of a suppressor. You would think that would screw things up terribly. So within group selection alone, extinction is guaranteed. So for selection to work at the level of collectives, there needs to be opportunity for competition, well, variation between groups, and then for competition to take place between groups. We tried a variety of ways of implementing between group selection. That's another story. What we ended up is doing this, which is a kind of a gentle between group selection. So here are eight microcosms in our experimental regime. There are inevitably extinction events. When there is an extinction event, we allow a replacement. So it's effectively we're implementing a Moran process. When there's a death, there is opportunity for a birth. So if there is death here because there is no mat, there is the microcosm that's available, and it is founded by another type. This stage here, it's at random. Up here, if there is no wrinkly spreader group up here, then we take the wrinkly spreader from that group that is most productive. So at one stage, we are selecting on an aspect of fecundity. Otherwise, we've got replacement if there is a death. On average, we would get between two and three deaths, therefore replacements, at each stage of the cycle. So here, selection operates both within and between groups and does so in a combination of both viability and fecundity. And here, the groups run the 10 generations without extinction. So between group selection delivers something. Now we have a control. Let me just go back. Here, too, a schematic of our life cycle, the group, the propagule. There is a bottleneck. This acts as a germ line, and reproduction is by virtue of this cycle. So we have a control, which controls for the life cycle. It's identical in every way, but it does not involve the germline stage. What we're going through is group. The groups are then fragmented. We become the means of reproduction. A single mat-forming cell then founds the next group. So here we're selecting on cooperation. One cooperating unit is the seed for the next round of the life cycle. Okay, and so you could think very much about this as a selection directly on competition, whereas the life cycle, directly on cooperation. Cooperation is part of the life cycle, but actually we're selecting on something that is more than just the sum of the activities of the individual cells. It is this capacity to go through the life cycle. So in this experiment, 10 group generations, life cycle, 15 replicates, and then the controls, the mat to mat, I will often refer to them as. At the end of this experiment, we did what you would expect. We measured the fitness of the derived groups, the 10 generation groups. How we did that, I can explain. I can see I'm already running out of time. Later, it will take me too long at this stage, but I have pictures. We can go over it. But what we are doing effectively is to take derived groups and pit them against ancestral groups and ask how many group level offspring do you produce. So we are measuring competitive performance by counting offspring groups. We also measure properties of the cells that make up those groups. We measure their growth rate, we measure cell density, in fact, we measure many different properties. So what we're interested in here is the properties of the collective. To what extent has collective fitness improved by counting the capacity of derived to leave offspring relative to ancestral? We're also looking at the properties of the cells that make up those groups. How would we know if something interesting has happened? Well, this in itself is a long story. Rick Michaud had an important idea, and I think it's one that is very important to think about. So during this stage here, as we go from the first groups to groups that have some capacity to behave as Darwinian machines in their own right, we would expect some sort of fitness decoupling. So back here, the fitness of these groups is, there is no emergent fitness. Fitness of the groups is explained completely by the properties of the individual cells that make up these collectives. However, at this stage here, we would expect, it makes sense, and for various reasons, for the fitness of collectives to no longer be determined solely by the fitnesses of the individual cells that make up those collectives. And we have an example of that here. So this collective has 9 cells. This one's got 16 cells. So from this MLS1 perspective, you would say this is the fittest group, but we are interested in the reproductive capacity of these groups, and we see that although this has made a fewer cells, it leaves 2 group level offspring in the same period that this has failed to reproduce. Fitness decoupling, then, we would expect to see here. The notion that the fitness of the groups is no longer explained solely by the fitness of the individual cells. We would also expect to see some evidence of, well, if these groups have participated in the process of evolution by natural selection, there is reason to expect that there be traits adaptive at the level of the collective. Now, working this out is not straightforward. The philosophers and so on have thought long about it. You can be fooled. Here is an example of where one could be fooled. So here is a herd of fast-running deer. Here is a herd of slow-running deer. Imagine some process whereby herds reproduce. This herd splits in two, and the same time that this fails to split in two. Selection, you would say, has acted at the level of the herd. This herd, fast-running deer, is more fit than this. However, in this case, it's very clear that herd success is a byproduct of selection between deer. It's a property of individuals. It's not property of the collective. So just because you see evidence of selection acting at the group level, one wants to ask, what is the evidence that the trait that has improved group level performance is a direct consequence of selection acting at the group level? Okay, I will really whiz through this. So what did we find? Here we have group fitness relative to the baseline, baseline scaled to 1. Here's our life cycle, here's our control, so this is our mat to mat. And we can see that the groups have improved in fitness. But we can see if we measure, no matter what property we measure of the individual cells, we can see that individual cell fitness has also improved. So you would reasonably look at that and look at that and go, well, this is not surprising. It's probably explained completely by improvements in individual cell fitness, which after all, you would expect after many generations selecting a mat to mat to mat, you would expect the mat growing cells to grow faster. What about our life cycle? Well, once again, we see in our life cycle treatment the group fitness improve, but we also see that performance, whatever level measure of cell level performance we look at, the cells that make up the groups, the fitness has actually declined relative to baseline. So that's pretty persuasive for the evolution of some sort of fitness decoupling here. We can no longer explain the fitness of groups on the basis of the fitness of the lower level entities. There seems to be evidence here of fitness decoupling. Now, you can forget all that's written. I'll try and give you the precede version. We wanted to know what's happened during the course of this period of selection. So we broke it down to look on a day-by-day basis at each stage of the life cycle for all of the derived types. And we did the same for the baseline types. In effect, looking at the life history and how that's changed during the course of evolution. There is the 6-day period, which is phase one, and there is a 3-day period, which is phase two. We harvested 3 microcosms every single day for double the length of the phase for 12 days, and we determined the frequencies of types that were there at each stage. We also doubled this period of time, a huge, huge experiment. The short of it is that what has changed most dramatically is the capacity of the derived lines to give rise to the other type. So if we start here with the mat-forming type through this period here, we see that the black dots here represent the baseline. This is the likelihood that we find the propagule present in the tube at this period of time. We can see this red line here, or these red dots here, a very significant increase in the likelihood that the derived mat-forming type throws up the other type. And I'll flick through 3 other graphs here which show that this is not explained by increases in overall cell density as you might perhaps consider. Here is a heat map for the baseline. So this has not gone through the evolutionary cycle. Here are our 15 groups. They're ranked by group fitness. Highest group fitness, lowest group fitness. These are the days, day 6 and then doubled, day 3 and then doubled, phase 1. Phase two. What do the colors represent? They represent the proportion of those 3 microcosms, okay, thank you, I will, that contain the other type. So a dark red colony, a dark red box means that up here, by chance, there was a group that, in fact, right from the outset was very good at producing the other type. If you can produce the other type, particularly the propagules, you are likely to have high fitness. You can see down here, very low fitness. What happened after evolution? Well, you can see there is much more red here. Many more groups have evolved the capacity to transition quickly, it would seem, to the other state. Let me flick straight forward. So there are only 2 ways to account for this. Either the propagules that arise grow really, really, really fast, which is possible, or otherwise, the propagules are being produced at a much higher rate. One needs to be able to separate selection from mutation here. But one can do that because we can measure the growth rates of the propagules. Let's just get rid of that. And what we see is for the derived propagules, they grow, in fact, much slower, their doubling time, than the original ancestor type. The fittest groups, 10 generations that leave most offspring, transition rapidly between states. They've not done this by an improvement in growth rate. Putting it in this way, early on there were some lines that did really well by virtue of smooth types or propagules that grew fast. After a period of evolution, what has happened is that strategy has not just spread, there has been the evolution of the capacity to transition rapidly between different states. One can see it with this rapid flipping backward and forward of colony phenotypes. And under the microscope, we would expect that with a theoretical model. One can do a contextual analysis to ask at what level is selection operating in order to deliver those high transition rates. The answer is that you can explain improvements in the mat-to-mat regime by improved growth rate. You cannot explain the high fitness of collectives in the life cycle regime by growth rate. In fact, it's negatively regressed. What explains collective fitness is this high transition probability of individual cells. Some of the genetics has been done in some lines. It is possible, as I alluded to before, for these groups to free themselves of the capacity or the requirement for mutation to move between these different states and to do so via epigenetic switches that take advantage of bistability in metabolic networks, some of which are understood in some detail. So some conclusions, and I really will shut up. So life cycles, I think, are critical here. The evolution of some means of collective reproduction, they may seem as though they would be impossible almost to evolve in simple steps, but we saw in Mike's talk that they can come effectively for free. There are some ideas I presented, one of which we've experimentally realized, this type 3 type of micro of organism. Life cycles in a single step provide opportunity for reproduction of collectives. Selection can therefore, in principle, work at that higher level. Life cycles also provide opportunity for fitness decoupling. In fact, I'd say it's almost inevitable that a life cycle will result in fitness decoupling. And even to the extent that perhaps once you get a life cycle going, transitions in individuality are almost inevitable, given an appropriate ecology. Here, the data that I skipped over provides fairly compelling evidence, firstly of fitness decoupling, but also that the trait that explains the improved performance of groups, the transition probability, is a direct consequence of selection acting at the higher level. There we are once again, my collaborators, support for opportunity to think, money, and particularly I'm very grateful to be here for an extended period of time, thanks to KITP. Thank you.
Sorry, I got a bit confused by sort of life cycles and the multicellularity group aspect of the story, right? So you can imagine sort of simple, so I guess the unique aspect of the life cycle in your experiment I always thought was the fact that it was triggered by recurrent mutations. Right, so every time it had to be reinvented. But if I understand correctly, now you in a way would like to turn it into a sort of phenotypic switch, of which we of course know many examples, as transitions from one kind of nutrient to another, or from fermentation to respiration.
Yes, and,
Those cycles, of course, are naturally driven by, in a much simpler way, right, just by environmental cycling.
Yes. That's right. So here, so one is always constrained by the particular starting material. So here, our wrinkly spreader mats. You know, again, we're dealing with an organism here that has not made any transition toward multicellularity. So it's very much a bottom-up approach. And so forced to think about, well, what you have to contend experimentally with what you're presented to start with. Here, these groups don't have that capacity to switch between these different states by some sort of developmental pathway. It's driven by mutation. Oh, yes, you could. You could do it different ways. I could even engineer this organism so that I took
precisely, you could engineer an epigenetic switch and then
I could, but of course, I want to see how it could evolve from a particular starting position. I mean, I may be surprised, but so here we have something that doesn't have this ability. Indeed, we would expect it, if it's to go anywhere, to evolve the capacity eventually for this life cycle to come under developmental control. I mean, that would be cool to be able to see the evolution of development, of course. It may be that in certain organisms, and we see this in the Ratcliffe experiment, it comes for free. And in what Rick Michaud was talking about this morning, the coupling of a gene that is already serendipitously coupled to some environmental factor. So yes, it definitely could come for free. Here it doesn't. Here very much it needs to evolve. The only way we could experimentally see this getting going, short of us intervening, was via mutation. And it's possible. And one of the surprises is, of course, that it's relatively easy, to go through this life cycle to a point where kind of break the controls that the genome has, there's some quite significant rewiring that goes on. You then end up with a switch that is flipping stochastically, and one could imagine there, perhaps if we were to keep this experiment going, that coming under some sort of environmental control. So again, if you wanted to engineer, I would take an oxygen-responsive promoter, couple it to the production of glues, and we would have something that was already developmentally regulated, and they possibly exist.
So you seem to be developing faster and faster transition rates. At what stage would you say that something no longer qualifies as a life history and more as just a transient expression state? So you're claiming that there's this propagule that is a stable state, but if things are transitioning on the order of time scales less than division time, presumably you wouldn't consider that a life history.
I guess it depends at what perspective you take. If the organism is viable, through this regime, then it's part of its strategy for getting through. I would expect as time goes by for a stochastic switch to tune itself to the frequency of environmental change and to optimize. And again, theory says actually that switch rate should be high. And we've only just begun to take apart these genetically, but just look at all phenotypically, looking at these kind of these mats at day six, it seems that these organisms have found these mats have found ways of dealing with how to be a mat at 6 days, avoid being sunk by cheats, investing minimal into the mat. You only want to invest enough into the mat to produce a viable mat. After that, you want to produce, all your reproductive effort wants to go into propagules to maximize the likelihood you go around. They've done some quite remarkable things. I don't know what they've done, but that it gets tuned to the environmental regime is likely. And indeed, I didn't have time to go into it. The fact that we extended the 6 day to 12, we doubled, you can see that everything is already tuned to 6 days. In fact, had we shifted it the time, we would see a tuning to
it. Okay, Paul, we got one last question.
You mentioned that the groups that undergo a bottleneck could persist for 10 generations, and I wonder if you try to push them further, and what was the abundance of those groups as a function of generation?
I didn't quite hear it. So you're interested in the bottleneck and the possibility that we...
Yeah, you mentioned that you could keep these groups going for 10 generations. You mentioned that you could keep those groups for 10 cycles.
Yeah,
and I wonder if you try to push it further and see if they diminish in time or over generations, or you can actually maintain a stable sized population for a really long number of cycles.
So how are you thinking about, you're wondering about the fitness of the cell? Currency that we're talking about? Fitness?
I'm asking about the long-term stability of having these cycles with a bottleneck. Because in your initial attempt, you noticed that without competition, right?
Yeah.
It decayed for...
Yes, okay.
And the cycle vanished after 7 cycles. And
right.
You mentioned that with competition,
yes,
you managed to get 10 cycles. But I wonder if that continues or...
Well, I would say yes, and that what we see after 10 cycles with between group competition are groups that have considerably improved their group level performance relative to the ancestral type. So I would expect that to go on improving. The more interesting thing, I think, is the degree to which the cell level performance may continue to decrease and the extent to which one de-Darwinizes that level.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay, thank you.
All right, break time.